Hello, welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. I first came across Elizabeth Povinelli's work when I read her book, The Cunning of Recognition, back in 2002. At the time, I was working on my PhD, and that was not long after I had been working with Aboriginal communities in South Australia, supporting them in their land rights claims, which are called native title claims. What I had observed was that Aboriginal communities were being put through very complicated processes to have basic rights recognized. But what was being recognized was much more a right to negotiate with mining companies and the government rather than having substantial return of land, which was the demand that Aboriginal communities have been making of the colonial governments. Povinelli was writing about these modes of recognition, but importantly, her experience takes us back to the 1970s and the older scheme of land rights recognition that had been put in place in 1976. And what that system had introduced was a very rigid form of social anthropology, which narrowed down Aboriginal relationships with the land, but also the relationships with each other by requiring very narrow kinship structures and biological descent as the basis for recognition. Povinelli explains how this stands in stark contrast with how Indigenous groups themselves understand the relationships with each other, as well as the knowledge systems and concepts that they have to understand extremely complicated relationships between land, geological features, geographical places, and each other. In her most recent book, Geontologies, A Requiem to Late Liberalism, which we discuss in this podcast, Povinelli develops a very important analysis of the need to break down the strong distinction between life and non-life. Geological features like deserts, creeks, the ocean, fog, etc., are often treated as inert and in stark contrast to human life or animal life. And this is a distinction that goes back to Western metaphysics and Aristotelian concepts. Povinelli has worked with the Currumbing community in Belyuen in the Northern Territory of Australia for over three decades. And what she suggests is that we can learn a great deal from the Currumbing about how life and non-life are deeply entangled, co-constitute, and compose each other. For example, one of the things we discuss in the podcast is the story around Djelbek, which is a fog, a particular kind of fog that is seen in this particular area in the Northern Territory. And it is something that is breathed in by humans and is an excellent example of how something that is regarded as non-life actually is ingested within ourselves as humans. So the lungs, our human lungs, become the site of an interaction between what is outside and what is inside. Moving beyond the rigid distinctions of what is treated as inert, to be acted upon by humans and extracted as resources, is a very urgent priority in the context of climate change, global resource depletion and more generally what is understood as the Anthropocene. Elizabeth Povinelli and I spoke about this book a few weeks ago. She was in New York and I was in London, and I was trying out some new remote recording software, and I think for the most part it seems to have gone fairly well. Hello, Beth. Thanks for joining me on Countersign. How are you doing?
I'm good. I think more importantly, my Cotterbing family in Australia is fine. And as we all know, yet again, when these kinds of events happen, they hurt and hit those who have already been made vulnerable by the long persisting history of settler colonialism and racism. So I'm fine, other than an itchy throat. And everyone.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah. So that's a good place to start, actually, with your connection to the Cotterbing, which is so central to your book, Geontologies. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how that connection started, which is now one that has been over about 35 years?
Yeah, we're into 36, I think. Well, it began in 1984 when I had graduated from a very small liberal arts philosophy college, St. John's College in Santa Fe. And I received a Watson Fellowship to leave the country. And the Watson Fellowships basically just want the recipients to leave the U.S. It's a great fellowship that way. And I had seen... Ironically, I'd seen a bunch of Australian films in the local Santa Fe, independent cinema. So I wrote a very short proposal to go to Australia and see how changing economic practices have altered the social life of Indigenous women. I have no idea where I got that idea. Since at St. John's, you begin with the great books. No, sorry. St. John's is a great books program. So you begin with the Greeks and you go up it through the German Enlightenment and history ends. So it's a very Western ideologically framed program in which everybody's European, everybody's white, and everyone is a man. But I wrote, it must have been from these films, and I wrote this proposal. I went to Australia, to Darwin. It was 84, so the infrastructure was different. There was a little community, Belyuen, located on the opposite side of the Darwin Harbor on a peninsula. So I had enough money to buy a motorcycle. I motorcycled across, met one of the older men at Belyuen, who's passed away. And I started camping on the beaches. They asked why I was there. I said, I'm a philosopher. They said, can you write a grant? I said, yeah. So they invited me to write, child care.
A philosophical grant.
A philosophical grant, yes. So I wrote, they said, if you come and work with the older women on the community in the Women's Center, you can stay on the community. And the thing to know is, two things to know. First, My white family, my natal family, I suppose, my biological family, on my father's side, comes from a little village in the Alps, just right below the Dolomites. Mm-hmm. They, in our family, in the Povinelli family, there's a very intense attachment to that village and its surrounding mountain lands. And there persists an imaginary around how you pick up your rights and your forms of belonging to that village And that imaginary, because it doesn't quite work this way anymore, but that imaginary is that there were five original families, and you pick up your rights to the village, the houses, the pastures for the cows, through your father and your grandfather. And there, and so when I went to Australia and we were hanging out, oh, sorry, the second thing to know is that I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, in the deep south of the U.S. We moved down there when I was two, and it was 1964. Now, 1964, 1965 are the years that the Civil Rights Act, was passed, and the Voting Rights Act was passed in the U.S. So this were we moved during the height of desegregation, anti-desegregation struggles in the Bible Belt. So our family was very odd down there. We were these Italian white Northerners. And my father built a house on the edge of the woods. So there were six kids. So we grew up in the woods, hunting, gathering, you know, everything. So when I went to Australia, there was a really intense fitting between how the older people and younger people thought about how they were attached to land, and a deep fitting between how I'd grown up in the woods hunting, you know, quote, gathering, meaning, you know, we collected bullfrogs and we bowled them in Dixie cups, and you can hear my Southern coming out. And so that there's this deep resonance between our lives, which made the structural placement of our lives so very clear. If our lives had so many analogies, then why was my life lifted up and theirs continually pushed down? So that go ahead.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's a really interesting question to pose at that moment, because it's the commonalities of attachment to land in within your natal family and your Caribbean family that you're pointing out there. But the other really interesting aspect of Australian history and politics is that the 1960s and 1970s were a time of great ferment in terms of recognition of Aboriginal rights. And as you know, the moment of the referendum in Australia in 1967, which is the moment where it's effectively the census referendum where Aboriginal people become recognized as certain kinds of citizens, or at least that's the narrative that is given in relation to those developments in the 1960s. So there's also this sort of parallel question about race politics and colonial politics between what's happening in Louisiana in the 60s and what's happening in Australia at the same time.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the racial imaginaries between the U.S. and Australia are super interesting and have been talked about before. So in the U.S., the racist imaginary that was legislated in Louisiana and throughout the South was one drop of African-American blood made you non-white. Whereas in, as you know, in Australia, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, one drop of settler blood made you a settler. And so you had these very different policies of identification and control. Mm-hmm. The second thing that's interesting is the very different colonial imaginary between Australia and the U.S. And in this way, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you see in those common, quote, Commonwealth countries, a much closer a national imaginary than you do between the U.S. and those other Commonwealth countries. Insofar as in the U.S., if you're white, and I think also for many African-Americans, the word colonial brings to mind, you know, red coats and blue coats. That is the revolution, right? It doesn't bring to mind the genocide, the slaughter, the dispossession, and its ongoing nature. Right? So in Louisiana, I lived in a place called Caddo Parish, right? Welcome to Caddo Parish. Well, where were all the Caddo? What happened to them? And that was just this void in the conversation around the legacies, the vicious legacies of slavery. And thus, in the U.S., there's always this very complex movement between the politics of dispossession, settler dispossession, and the politics of the enslavement of West Africans. Not that they clash, but rather that the national imaginary just can't keep them in the same frame. So when I went to Australia, the foregrounding of Indigenous politics was super enlightening to me. And thus the different kind of struggles that ensued in the 60s and 70s. So in the U.S., we also had the rise of, you know, the Indians of All Nations, Red Power Movement, et cetera, et cetera. But the way these are articulated are somewhat different. And this might be relevant to Gianto power as a concept later when we get to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I wanted to just dwell on the moment there in 1984. So you arrive and you meet the community in Belyun.
Oh, so I go there and I just think, I mean, you know, it's what philosophers call an ontology, but I don't. But their analysis of existence and the manner in which various modes of existence were kept in place or rearranged themselves was just, you know, totally brilliant and captivating and everything, right? But they were, the community had been involved in a land claim since 1976 when the Aboriginal Land Rights Act of the Northern Territory was passed. Mm-hmm. As you know, but listeners might not, the Land Rights Act of 76 was a far more conservative piece of legislation than the original bill that was proposed to the parliament in 1975. The original bill was proposed by a Labor government.
That's right, the Whitlam government, which was then dismissed by the end of that year, by November 75.
That's right. So they dismissed the Whitlam government. And who came after Whitlam?
Fraser.
Yeah.
Malcolm Fraser.
That's yeah, right. Of course. Sorry. I purposely blot him out. So Fraser's government introduced a new bill, and the new bill was conservative in this way. It set down a set of conservative social anthropological norms that all Indigenous groups had to meet in order to, the language around this is so weird, in order to get back what was already theirs, right? This idea that, you know, I always want us to like stumble over this because it's like someone steals your cup, right? And you say, you stole my cup. And they say, oh, this is terrible. We want to recognize the rights you have to your cup. So in order for you to get your cup back, what you need to do is show us how you meet a model devised by social anthropologists who are engaged in a debate in their own little discipline. And that's what happened. And that's why in the Land Rights Act, we have this concept of a local descent group, which is defined biologically. They have reduced the complex cultural system of belonging and attachment to human and more than human world to like biological reproduction.
This community had also asked you whether you were willing to be their lawyer, and you had said that you were not willing to do that. And you were completely against the kind of social anthropology that was going on at the time. So what happened next?
I said, any other options? And they said, what about anthropologist? And I said, what is an anthropologist? And always just spot on the mark, those old people. They said, white people studying us. I was like, wow, no, no. Because, you know, we had spent all this time thinking about, like, how does existence work? And I talked about how these philosophers thought about it, and they talked about, you know, so it's just this really great conversation. And then I was supposed to study them. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And they said, no. That's what anthropologists do. But what we could do if you be the anthropologist is you could help us, and we together could understand what's going on with land claim and these other pieces of legislation. So we made it wasn't a deal. We didn't sign it in a contract. I think it was honestly deeper than a contract, that what my role was to help as much as I could understand the form, mode, and conditions of settler power.
Yeah. So this is... Yes.
So I don't study them. And I don't translate them.
That's absolutely clear.
Yeah.
So I want to... I want to bring this period, actually, back to the book, Geontologies, mm-hmm. and the way in which you provide... a searing critique of what you term late liberalism. Mm-hmm. And part of late liberalism is, or one of the features of late liberalism in the settler context is that indigenous people are turned into what you refer to as animist or totemic figures. And mm-hmm. you've already alluded to this in the context of describing the land claims, where, you know, basically Aboriginal land is stolen, and in order to get some of it back or acquire some rights, and sometimes it's not getting it back in any kind of sense of sovereignty, but in order to acquire some negotiating rights in relation to mining licenses and so forth, Indigenous groups around Australia have to conform to some notion of being traditional or being native enough to receive native title rights and so forth. So there's a form of liberal recognition, which you've written about in your other books as well, and especially The Cunning of Recognition, but also in the books that followed that, where this is the mode in which colonial settler sovereign power is deployed in both genealogical terms, but also biopolitical terms. And part of what your book Geontologies is trying to do is to shift the analysis, shift the critique, as it were, the sort of critiques of sovereignty and biopolitics that we've seen informed by Foucault, Agamben, and others, to forms of analysis, and especially importantly, forms of analysis drawn from the Caribbean themselves that point to ways of being with non-life.
Right. Just
so that was a lot there, but I wanted to get the book in.
No. That's really that. I was just amazed. I'm always both honored and kind of amazed. No, I was going to say there's just one point that I would add to your really wonderful summary is that we need to remember that from the 1950s onward, the anti-colonial movement, the various new social movements, the the non-aligned movement, all of these were winning. They were ripping the legitimacy mask off of an older form of civilizational liberalism. That is,
this was the crisis, one of the crises of the liberal state in the 1970s.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Sylvia Winters and others have also pointed, of course, to this period because, you know, it's a well-known period. So that it's important for us to remember that recognition in all of its multiple forms is a reaction formation of liberalism under crisis. So the question was, how do we regain our legitimacy without giving up our power? And in the context of Indigenous Australia or Indigenous peoples in what is now called Australia, right? The state put Indigenous people in two binds, one of which was a discursive bind and one of which was an affective bind. The discursive bind was, indeed, as you say, you have to, fit an anthropological model that came from somewhere else. Now, you can say it came from Arnhem Land, or you can say it came from London and Manchester, and Cambridge and Oxford, right? And Sydney, where those folks went. But so on the one hand, you had to fit this foreign anthropological model in which you had to demonstrate you were different enough to like make it so very interesting to listen to you, but not so different that you triggered a moral repulsion and thus criminal law. And on the other hand, the second double bind is, or if it's even a bind, it was the insistence, I would say, that an Indigenous person identify, attach to a certain melancholic relation to the past, that is, at the affects of loss and losing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so That's what I was showing in the earlier work. What Geontologies started plunging more deeply into was a formation of power, a formation of governance that always underlay recognition and civilizational. So late liberal recognition or late liberalism, and let's say civilizational liberalism as two distinct forms. And what Geontologies argues is that the governance of existence based on the division between life and non-life subtended both civilizational liberalism and late liberalism, or we could call it recognition liberalism.
Yeah, and I think just a useful distinction to elaborate your concept of geonto power here, and again to distinguish it from the sort of work that Foucault, Agamben, and Esposito and the like have brought to bear on formations of liberal power, is that the focus of geonto power is on the life non-life distinction,
right?
Whereas the focus of those working within a framework of biopolitics is on different forms of life. So we know, for example, a lot of Agamben's work is oriented around notions of forms of life. And what is very significant about your analysis in geontologies is that it is non-life that takes center stage. And it is the relationship between various instances of non-life, the rock that might hear you, the creek that carries very different kinds of ancestral memories as well as present manifestations than the manner in which a creek would ordinarily be treated as a geological feature. So it is that very significant distinction that I think your book really animates, and it connects with a body of thinking in critical theory that broadly comes under the banner of object-oriented ontologies, and that's one of the or the sort of work that people like Jane Bennett and others have done on the vibrancy of matter. Now, you engage with all these critical thinkers, but I think you also distinguish your articulation of geonto power from the manner in which those thinkers have tried to engage with the agency of things and so forth.
Right. No, that's right. There's a central distinction I'm drawing between a biopolitical and a necropolitical analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yes, importantly.
Right. Is between life and non-life. But it's essential to understand that death is a crucial figure of the biopolitical and obviously the necropolitical mm-hmm. imaginary and state. Yes. So for instance, not for instance, if you look at Agamben, Esposito, Foucault, the long arm of Heidegger, mm-hmm. the long arm of Aristotle, right? And Aristotle very centrally and obviously in Agamben, yes. right? The division between that which is in existence or comes into existence, the distinction between those forms of existence that can be born, can persist, reproduce, and most essentially die. Or if you want to put it in philosophical terms, that which can be an event, that which can have connotus and effectus, and right. that which faces finitude, are pulled out of existence and made the foundation of ethics, politics, and sociality.
Yeah. And so, I think important the Aristotelian connection here is also the important right. Distinction between actuality and potentiality.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I always found it, you know, ironic that and this goes way back to the St. John's years, obviously, that here's Aristotle, who, you know, is centers the question of actuality or actualization in his metaphysics and ontology. He centers that whole the process of becoming set against the set against ends, right? What will I have been? Will I have become an oak, right? Or will I have stunted just in a little seedling or something? And the way then in which Agamben differentiates two kinds of potentiality, that, you know, the potential a positive potentiality, right?
Yes, potentiality and impotentiality.
Yeah, impotentiality, right? So I choose not to, right? Mm-hmm. But still within this framework of, you know, what will I have actually done, that future retrospective. So our ethics are based on this, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is positioned against, from Aristotle on, positioned against those things that are in existence, that are fully actualized. Those things which have the potential to be actualized are set against those things that are fully actualized when they come into existence. For instance, a rock. There is no inner,
exactly.
Right? Right. And I always thought it was super ironic. It's like, why don't we elevate then the rock to the highest form of existence since it reached actualization mm-hmm. in its very nature? But no, It's the drama of might not have been. I could have been a player, you know, or right. I was the greatest of all time. That's the Western imaginary that centers the governance of civilizational liberalism and late liberalism. And it does so by setting European man on the top of that Agamben forms of life, right? So it's, you know, it's Western man that has most actualized the human potential. And then in that vicious racial settler assault, lined up other humans, if the Europeans even allowed them to be human, but lined them up as, well, different forms of human who hadn't quite yet actualized themselves the way that the Europeans did, right? Yeah. So you have a racial and a civilizational logic to the life side. And then underneath the humans, you get all these finer discussions about, well, dolphins or higher, you know, all that. But on the other side, you have this, quote, inert world that is just treated as if it was, I mean, it's just psychotic, as if you could do anything to it and nothing would be done because of it, right? Mm-hmm. And what deontologies is trying to say is, look, it's not a decision of sides. It's not, I choose life, I choose non-life. I choose the side of non-life. I choose to reinterpret the entire philosophical, ethical, social, and political condition from the perspective of non-life. No. How do we refuse the division itself? That the division is the problem. Now, that the reason that we can even start speaking in this way, those of us who are in the West, is for, on the one hand, because others have been screaming for a very long time, you know, that this division isn't in existence. It's the way Europeans are governing their existence, right? Mm-hmm. Their human and more than human existence. So on the one hand, like, it finally maybe pushed through the very thick skulls of some folks. Yeah. But the reason maybe it's pushed through, and not surprising, is that the emergence of the notion of the Anthropocene, of climate collapse, suddenly makes Europeans, or that Western tradition, those Western people, worried that what they had offloaded onto other forms of existence, human and more than human, was suddenly returning to them, right? Yeah. That is, they suddenly said, oh my goodness, this division is not in existence, it's governing existence. And now we care because it's hurting us. And let's really just, let's speak a little truth here. No one gave a damn in those kind of settler Western capitalist worlds until it was hitting them. Yeah. Now, the way in which I relate to, say, the object-oriented ontologies, the new materialisms, etc., and they're very complex little discursive field, and I approach them most directly in, I think it's... I can't remember what chapter it is.
Well, I can tell you, you do a terrific job. I think it's one of the clearest expositions of Quinton Mellesu and Graham Harman I've seen, and I can tell you, you did it in chapter three.
Three, that's the one. Yeah, it's
in the fossils three. And the bones.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and for me, it's really important because the we look at the fossil, we don't look at the rock, we look at the bone, right? We don't look at the calcium fields in which it's extended. But the way I approach them in the most general sense is that I see them as one of the symptomatic figures emerging in Western theory as geonto power starts not working for the West. Right. So if we say Gianto power was, Gianto power isn't after bio power. It's not like sovereign power, bio power, Gianto power. No. Gianto power has been operating in the open throughout the colonial reach of the West and in the West, in Europe, and then it's in its diaspora into these colonizing spaces. But it only becomes apparent to that imaginary when it starts affecting them directly. So what I argue is that there are three figures that are symptomatic to this moment that liberalism is in. So if 60, 70s, 50s, 60s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, we could say is a period in which this new formation of liberalism is emerging, late liberalism. We could say nowish, maybe, we'll see, we might be in a new period in which late liberalism itself is rearranging, and as we see the rise of these new eco-fascists, the closing of borders, the relationship of that closing in those eco-fascisms to climate migration, et cetera, right? What I say is maybe this is a period. And if so, then we're seeing these symptoms, these theoretical symptoms manifest as figures. And I give three figures. And the figure of the desert, the figure of the animus, the figure of the virus. And in geontologies, I'm trying to be very clear that these are figures. They're not, they include, but are not real. They don't include. They're not actual deserts. They're not actual people who the anthropological imaginary has decided to call animus or totemists. And they're not actual viruses. And we can come back to that, this part. Rather, these are three different ways in which we can analytically see how critical theory is manifesting symptoms of the shaking of Gianto power. The desert.
I just wanted to come in on that because okay. So what I wanted to come back was the term you just mentioned, which is the way in which the figures operate in your analysis in terms of signs of manifestation. I think that's a phrase that comes up again and again throughout the chapters. And this is quite central to how you're not trying to create some opposition between life and non-life, but rather to identify the manifestations of the relationship between life and non-life. And that's a very important move, because what it avoids is the sort of anthropomorphization of non-life that we see in some new materialisms, and so on. So it's a way of explaining the co-presence of the manifestations of these figures, the desert, the animist, the virus, as the figures of Gianto power. And I wonder, you could come back on that, but I wonder whether it would be helpful to explain these figures through one of the actual encounters with either two women sitting down or Old Man Rock or one of the manifestations of the life, non-life manifestation that you articulate.
That's really interesting. I would say that the figures, the three figures of Gianto power, as opposed to, say, the four figures of bio power, are manifestations of Gianto power as it's losing its self-evidence. In the book, I also refer to a distinction that the parents and grandparents of contemporary Katabing made and many people continued to make that isn't related to Gianto power, but is related to how they analyze existence and how they analyze the psychosis of Gianto power or Western approaches to existence. So concretely, when I won't use the creek or, and we can come back to two women sitting down, but perhaps the winds, the fog, mm-hmm. Chelbeck.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Which I use as an example in order to push against even Jacques Rancière's understanding of politics and policing. Mm-hmm. So Chelbeck is a... Chelbeck refers to fog. In Caribbean countries are on the northwestern coast of Australia. Of the Northern Territory. And there are fog seasons. So especially in the transition from the build down. So there's rain season, build down, dry season, build up, rain, build down, et cetera, et cetera. And so Chelbeck just refers to the fog and fogs come in. There's a particular kind of Chelbeck, though, that is long and tubular and moves and it follows creeks. Mm-hmm. And Chelbeck, like other forms of existence, can smell. Now, it's really important to like understand this sensory understanding of existence. That is touch, smell, sweat, taste, all of these senses are more widely shared across modes of existence. And all of these play a really important role to understanding how what one form of existence, the practice, how one practice of existence affects another practice of existence. Now, I'll get concrete. So Chelbeck. So, you know, we were all in Caribbean, we were all raised by the older people to distinguish between Chelbeck, which is just fog, and these Chelbeck creatures. And we were told that they can smell you and they can smell the differences between people that belong to country and people that don't belong to country. Like many forms of existence, like a kangaroo can smell itself and distinguish itself from other things. But as we were, you know, as time is going, Chelbeck, fog in general, and these creatures not only could smell, like they can smell the differences in heat and cold and thus form themselves, right? They could all, they also started smelling different. They started smelling like, well, not fog, but smog. Mm-hmm. Now, as they smelled like smog rather than fog, suddenly our relationship to them also changed. So how they smell to how we breathe them in and they breathe us in, right? Change. Mm-hmm. That is, we're not inside or outside each other. We're both inside and outside each other. That is, life is not inside or outside of non-life. Life and non-life are inside and outside of each other, and thus the distinction and difference really makes no difference unless you're thinking of it as a mode of governance. Now, why are these fogs smelling different? Well, because, say, for instance, two women sitting down is being treated different. What's two women sitting down? Well, two women sitting down is an ancestral site for the Kunupi in around Timber Creek, and it is if you looked at it, a lot of people say it's a rock formation that includes manganese. It's primarily manganese, but it's not. It's a bandicoot mother and a rat mother, and they fought over their kids, as often things do. And in fighting, they ripped each other and they bled, and the blood is the manganese. And it's right there. You can see it, right? So under Northern Territory and federal legislation around what's called the Sacred Sites Act, Indigenous people who belong to Two Women Sitting Down and to whom Two Women Sitting Down also belong to, that is, they're inside and outside of each other, and they're not one or the other, can identify and protect the site. But in order to do so, they have to give it a boundary. That is, they have to create it as if it was something that had a skin, in which you could say, inside this boundary is Two Women Sitting Down, outside this mm-hmm. boundary is not Two Women Sitting Down. Well, that's just nuts. It's like the fog. Mm-hmm. It's like, really? Because the fog is inside of me and I'm inside of it. And now we're going to see that the fog, which has turned to smog, is inside and outside of not only Two Women Sitting Down, but where it went to China. Because Two Women Sitting Down, once it was registered, was then mined by a big mining company which wanted to scoop out the manganese, sell it to China, right, to make iron, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so the mining company went up to the boundary of Two Women Sitting Down and they cut vertically down, so far down that they undermined the structural integrity of the site, or we would say Two Women Sitting Down, and part of it fell into the mining pit. For the first time ever, the Aboriginal Areas and Protection Authority, under a really great director and Indigenous board, sued the mining company for desecration. And they won because they showed that the mining company knew that if they, you know, they have structural engineers whose whole dissertations are on geological integrity, right? And so they knew mm-hmm. if they did this, they would damage the site. Mm-hmm. Two things. Why didn't they sue for attempted murder, mm-hmm. right? Well, because a rock doesn't have standing as life. It can't do it, right? You can't murder a rock. And second, where is Two Women Sitting Down? Is Two Women Sitting Down where those, you know, you say, well, here's Bandicoot and here's Rat and here's their blood, the manganese. Well, if it's their blood, then Two Women Sitting Down goes where the manganese goes. Is Two Women Sitting Down only those, or is it the entire formation of existence that keeps it in place, right? Including perhaps the smog that returns over, you know, over the oceans, back to the Northern Territory, and slowly corrode the site. So what Katabing are saying is, like, what's wrong with settlers? What is wrong that they cannot understand that if you undermine a formation, then it will undermine you? If you turn your back on it, it will turn its back on you, right? Because it's nothing smooth. It's not like, well, everything's inside of everything, therefore, you know, everything is the same. No, everything is the specificities of shape, including our shape, are dependent on keeping in place the specificities of other shapes. I will tell you something that the Dene critical Indigenous scholar Glenn Coulthard wrote. And he wrote it about, he was writing about the Dene's resistance to the Mackenzie pipeline that was going through, they wanted to push it through Vancouver. Just outside of Vancouver. And during this land claim, which was also in the 1970s, it wasn't a land claim, it was the Berger Inquiry. And Berger, the commissioner of this inquiry, also spoke with Woodward, who was the, I don't know if you know, but Woodward did first inquiry into, like, if we gave land rights, what would it look like, right, in Australia? Mm-hmm. But anyways, mm-hmm. so Berger was interviewing the Dene And there were other lawyers and stuff. And a couple Dene elders were being questioned about country that was inside Dene territory, but the Dene themselves rarely, if ever, went to. And the mining companies and the mining company lawyers, or sorry, the gas company and the gas company lawyers asked these Dene men, you like, so you don't go there, right? And the Dene men said, no, it's the caribou's country. And they said, yeah, right. So the lawyer said, yeah, right. So you don't go there. And they said, and the Dene said, no, it's the caribou's country. And they said, so exactly. So why do you care what goes on there? Right. And the Dene said, because caribou need their country too, and we need caribou. Right. And here's just this, and again, it's not as if Gianto power is some new idea that I came up with. Native Americans, First Nations, Indigenous people, and others have been screaming this in people's ears forever, which is, if I don't care, if I don't allow other forms of being to be according to the way they are, and this is not just caribou, this is a creek, a set of manganese formations, fog. If I don't allow these other forms of existence to remain in existence in their own way, irrespective of me, then I can't remain in existence either. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's really important not to say, well, I'm on the side of non-life. No, mm-hmm. It's the division is psychotic. And that psychosis mm-hmm. is at the heart of liberalism and capitalism. And it creates the toxicity that then circulates back and demonstrates the truth of this analytic of existence, this coda-being analytic of existence.
That's a really nice point to refer to the normativity of life, non-life.
Right.
And I think that's the sort of relationship, the relation, and you put it very evocatively in talking about fog, smog, that is both inside and outside, where the lungs, our lungs,
right.
Are so central to the interface of the existence of life, non-life.
Right.
And what comes out of this relation is a very strong sense of normativity, that an appreciation of these relations, an attentiveness to the manifestations of life, non-life, offers all life and non-life a normative framework for existence.
Right.
And I think that, of course, again, is something that Indigenous First Nations Aboriginal people, as you say, have been screaming out for centuries. Mm-hmm. And now it is, you know, perhaps we're hearing it a little more, a little better, as in the times of a pandemic or of this virus of COVID-19, our lungs appear to have become the most fragile location of life and existence. But of course, it also applies to the extinctions that people are much more conscious of in the context of climate change.
I don't want to end on a Debbie Downer moment, but you know, just to go back to where we began, my job, I suppose, is to watch really carefully with my colleagues how in these moments, those who have benefited from this psychotic form of governance are going to do everything in their power to adjust without giving away any power, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. The extension of personhood to mm-hmm. nature, writ large, or particular spaces in nature, I see why one wants to do it. I see, and I think, God, anything to slow this down, fine. But my job is to remind us that what we're doing there is equivalent to what recognition did, and is equivalent yes, to what right. the animus did, which is to say, we recognize that you, the person, people, non-human form of existence that we have excavated, that we have extracted every last piece of value from in order to swell ourselves like blood ticks, right? We recognize that, oh, that was wrong because you're just like we are. You're me, but just different. So I'm going to let you be me, but you have to be me just different enough so you're not me, but you are me, right? And so the extension of rights onto nature is as everyone knows, comes from the extension of personhood to corporations. And then we backtrack from there to say, well, if a corporation can be a person, so can a river, so can a mountain, so can nature. Well, wait a minute. Why does it have to be a person? Mm-hmm. Right? Why does it have to be your kind of person, i.e. our kind of person, i.e. the Western kind of person, i.e. something that could be a corporation? Right? If a person can be a corporation, I don't want that kind of person. And this also extends to the idea that we just say, well, we need a parliament of nature. Really? Mm-hmm. Why does nature need to be parliamentary? What could possibly happen so that liberals would give up that which they hold most dear? What could they slaughter, kill, extract, you know, decimate? What is there any limit to what liberalism and liberal capitalism can do? We have to be so, so careful not to wind up where we've always wound up, which is, well, we're dispossessing you and enslaving you because that's for civilization. Oh, we're governing you and making you a supplement to us because that's recognition, right? Oh, mm-hmm. we're turning you into corporations because that's what you wanted in order to solve climate change. It's like, no, that's not what I hear Kotobing saying or other critical Indigenous activists and scholars.
Just very quickly, I mean, it's been wonderful to talk to you, Beth, and to discuss this really amazing book. Just very quickly before we go, what are you working on at the moment?
I just got the new book off my desk. It's called Between Gaia and Ground, and it centers mm-hmm. around what I call the four axioms of existence. The four axioms are, first, that existence is entangled, which in some ways we've been talking about. The second is that depending on where you are in that entanglement, your power to affect the entanglement or be affected by it differs. The third is that the concept of a political event or a social event has not only diversified but collapsed. And by that I mean that we no longer think of the political event, like the revolutionary event, but we think of quasi-events, small violences, etc. And also we understand that social power and political power works through intensifications that aren't even events. And then the fourth axiom is that Western ontologies and epistemologies are not only provincial, that is, they're Western, but dangerous. And that's really the kind of geontological insight. Sometimes we begin and end with axiom one. We say existence is entangled, and we think there's politics in that. And I say there is no politics in that. The argument is that in the book is that we not return to ontologies, we not return to the natural sciences epistemologies. Not that we just chuck them out or whatever, but whatever critical theory we're developing begins and ends in a specific history. And that specific history have been being written by many, many people, Clisson, Césaire, you just can go on and on, right? Mm-hmm. And which the point is not to develop a new ontology of existence rooted in these old epistemologies of existence, but to say the analytics of existence is always coming from somewhere in an entangled history and oriented to somewhere in that entanglement. So anyways, that's what I'm working on. And then there's also a graphic essay in the skin of a memoir that is going to be coming out next year too.
That sounds fantastic and amazing. And I'm going to look forward to reading and looking at those. And I'd love to have you back on Countersign, but for now, Elizabeth Povinelli, thank you very much for joining me on Countersign.
Stuart, you are brilliant and amazing. And anytime I can listen to you, I would welcome the chance.
Thanks, Beth.
You're welcome.
See you soon.
Bye.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.